Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world today, welcome back to The Caring Economy with me, Toby Usnick. On this podcast, we dive into the intersection of economics, philanthropy, and social good. So today, I'm truly honored to have with us Paula DiPerna. She's an author, a strategic global environmental and philanthropic policy advisor, who's also been a forerunner in the global effort against climate change. Paula's illustrious career spans several decades, and she has served on a multiple of advisory boards, which we'll talk about a bit today. And she's even worked with the legendary Jacques-Yves Cousteau and is a widely respected voice in an environmental arena. Her latest book, which we're also going to talk about today, is a nonfiction book called Pricing the Priceless. That's the short name. Pricing the Priceless, the financial transformation to value the planet, solve the climate crisis, and protect our most precious assets, which was published in June 2023 by Wiley and has been wonderfully reviewed even this past weekend by the Financial Times. So welcome to The Caring Economy, Paula.
Thank you, Toby. A pleasure to be with you.
So I'm surprised our paths haven't crossed before because we're both in a similar space. And before we go into details, I would love you to do as we do with other guests and just give us like a 2 or 3 minute digest of Paula, where you grew up, how you found your path, maybe some mentors or pivots that affected you along the way, and then we'll go from there.
Great. Well, I guess I could say, it's good that we haven't crossed paths before. It's always good to meet new people and, break the circle, so to speak, and avoid too much chat room of familiarity. But anyway, it's lovely to be with you and to meet you and hear what you have to say. So me, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker. I was born in New York City. I'm an absolute product of New York City public schools, public high school, public elementary school, just adore New York. And I then, of course, did my undergrad and grad at NYU in a big hurry, night school. Some friends have said that I specialize in being a New Yorker while being completely connected to the rest of the world. And so I feel that somehow that has happened and been true. All through my career, including, I think it was ninth grade English, Mr. Ross. Well, all kids remember a given teacher. You asked about mentors. So, Mr. Ross and Mrs. Ehrlich were my pivotal English teachers. And, they just turned me on to the idea that I could write and encouraged me about in writing and communicating and composing and composition and also revision. Ross was great in teaching you how to revise, not to take yourself so seriously that you couldn't cut something out. Go for the big fat first and then the little things later. And, I can hear him saying, shake it like a rug. You get the big dirt off first. That's exactly how I work. And I started writing about public schools because I was advised, by some people to write about what you know. So I got a gig running in the Village Voice, freelancing. And I had wanted to be a teacher. I didn't get a fellowship for a PhD program I wanted to go into. And I thought, all right, well, I'm not going to teach. I'm not going to be an academic. I'll just be a writer, as if that was easy. So I got some articles published in the Village Voice. And the reason I did that, if back to mentors, and I cite him in my book, in the acknowledgments, Victor Novosky, who you probably know or know of, recently died, and he was just the penultimate, consummate freelancer one, editor and publisher two, completely open to helping people when he didn't have to. And I took a class with him in graduate school, and I told him I had this yearning to be a writer. And so, well, what's your idea? And I gave him an idea, and he said, well, call so-and-so and tell him I said so. And I got the thing published in the Village Voice, thanks to that intro. I mean, it was hard. I had to do the hard work on the piece, but Victor opened the door. So he would be high up there as a mentor. And then, the real pivot, true pivot, was getting to work with Jacques Cousteau. And that was also a coincidence, had nothing to do with my wanting to be an environmentalist at all. But I knew that was science was there were a lot of new publications on science coming out and on, funnily enough, IT, which I'm not an expert on. But I thought, well, if I volunteer to work for Cousteau, he's famous, and then I'll learn something and I'll have a whole new set of subjects to write about. And they were looking for volunteers at that point to work on a book that they had a contract to do called the Cousteau Almanac. So I volunteered And the next, they were taking a lot of time with me. I didn't really understand, you know, why they were spending so much time. I was giving them time. They were taking a lot of my time. But I thought, all right, we'll see. And so the next day they called me and offered me a full-time position as a contributing editor and writer on that book project. And so I thought I'd take it for a year or so and ended up staying there 2 decades.
Wow.
And, you know, that was life transforming. Absolutely. And I wouldn't be talking to you today if I hadn't had that time with him. And, you know, we can talk more about it, but, you know, he was a unique character probably in world history for a number of reasons.
Yeah, he touched all of us. I mean, as a young kid, my brothers and I would watch all those Cousteau specials on TV and brought a world that we were Midwesterners, landlocked. So the whole sea was not something that we grew up with. So he definitely was that. And the other thing I'm reminded of when you described him and others, I was at a birthday celebration yesterday for Mikhail Baryshnikov. And when his daughter introduced him, she said of her father that he creates space for other artists, right? Mm-hmm. And I think great leaders do that. They actually do, certainly they have their egos and their own interests, but at the same time, the really inspirational ones I have found, like Cousteau, I think for you, or Baryshnikov yesterday, is making space for others and sort of sharing the wealth. Would you agree?
Totally agree. And, you know, I often say to people that I'm mentoring or staff that I work with, you know, I may be tough and I may at some point, you know, give you the impression of being cut and dried. I said, but, you know, you'll never work with anybody who cares more about your success than I do. You know, my role as a mentor is to make space. And I think the best leaders do understand, first, there's plenty of room at the top. And as we said, when we started, it's always good to get new, fresh faces and new voices into a topic. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, you know, it's exciting to move over. You know, it's tiring to hold everything in your own hands all the time. Yeah. And so it's a relief sometimes to say, hey, and especially for younger women, I'm very, very clear in my mind that that's, you know, a very important goal for me. And, you know, I try to work on all those fronts.
Give us a synopsis of those 20 plus years with Cousteau. Would you say that made you an environmentalist first and foremost, or did it make you a writer first and foremost? Or you stayed 20 years plus. So what was it, you know, got you like, this is my passion?
Well, they hired me to write, to work as a writer on that book. So that checked that box. I mean, that was a fantastic opportunity and a credit. First of all, just because I spoke Spanish. So we got the book published, Doubleday brought it out. And, you know, it's called the Cousteau Almanac. And in fact, there's nothing we're talking about today in any of the environmental areas that we didn't touch on in that book. I mean, that was in the 80s. I wrote about climate change. I wrote about almost everything, including manganese nodules that everybody's running around the world thinking about deep sea mining right now, which is, by the way, a catastrophe. So in that sense, you know, we were far out, very far forward looking, and he was a forward thinker. And but after the book, I thought, well, that would be that. And then because I spoke Spanish, the Cousteau Society, Calypso, had a contract in Venezuela, and they didn't have any Spanish speaker on the staff but me. And so they asked me to kind of sort out the contract and do the prep work. Well, that got to be complicated and they didn't get that job done finally. They didn't go to Venezuela. They got a contract with the National Film Board of Canada. And Cousteau said, well, you were going to go to the Venezuela. How'd you like to go to the St. Lawrence River? So dump the summer clothes, put on the winter clothes. And that's how he was. There was no one who didn't know who he was and no one who didn't want to work with him. And he was just an opportunist. Yeah. And whenever an opportunity came along. So at the beginning, for me, it was just the challenge of finding stuff out as a writer. You know, I need to coordinate when the ship should be in what part of the world, why, what's the story, you know, back to writing, what's the story? In this case, what's the story the film wants to tell? How do we tell it? When do we have to be where? Will we miss the Capelin, this flood, for example, of Capelin, these little tiny fish coming in, turning on the waves in the St. Lawrence River? When does that happen? So I had to do a bunch of research and organizational research. Mm-hmm. And then gradually I began writing the films, not all, but a good number of them. And in the end, I wrote a dozen of them. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating to work with him because, you know, writing for 47 minutes, 40 seconds, minus 20 minutes of music, And silence leaves you 20 minutes to say, use words, which, you know, that means you better make them count. And so that was a real challenge and great fun. But the other thing about him was, as I said, he gradually himself became aware that the filmmaking wasn't enough, that he had to use his prestige and his access to influence policymakers. And so literally, truly, he, you know, at that time, you could call people. Now, people never put their phone number anywhere. And so it's almost as if nobody wants to be reached. Right. The internet's supposed to make us broadly available. But in fact, it's the opposite. Mm. Everyone seems to be hiding, including newspapers, by the way. Just as an aside, I used to be able to call a newsroom and give them a tip. I don't know how they get tips now. Certainly, there's no way. That's why we keep reading the same thing over and over. But that's an aside. But at that time, you could call anyone. And I was he saw that I knew how to get stuff done, more or less. And so he put me in charge of his outreach to heads of state. Wow. And so that included George Bush and included, you know, people all around the world, because he began to see that he could lobby them for results. And in particular, we'll talk about Antarctica just, you know, briefly. But so, you know, the Antarctica Treaty is actually connected back to pricing the priceless and to our state of the world now. Mm-hmm. And the Antarctica Treaty, I wasn't born, but it was a fantastic agreement. There are, like, I think 26 countries that have a claim, a territorial claim on Antarctica, because mm-hmm. at some point they put a flag there. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there wasn't any idea about greenhouse gas emissions. There wasn't any idea we shouldn't be burning oil. There wasn't any idea about what might be under the ice, which at that point had not really melted much. And so there wasn't an agreement about how to divide up the spoils that could be there. And so the treaty just simply said, nobody's going to press their claims on this continent until we make progress on figuring out how to divide up the riches. And that hiatus lasted almost two decades, to the world's benefit. You could call it inertia, but the inertia helped keep Antarctica from, you know, detrimental activity. Anyway, Cousteau, the hiatus was coming to an end, and countries were beginning to try to figure out how to divide up the spoils, who would get what. And Cousteau had just been in Antarctica and understood the weather conditions there. And I hadn't been, but he said to me, look, this process of opening up Antarctica can't be allowed to go forward. We have to stop it. And it was called the Wellington Convention. And a lot of countries, including the United States, were invested in getting that ratified. So, you know, Cousteau weighed in, and we went to see President Bush the first a couple of times, and he weighed in with François Mitterrand, and I think his name was Hawke. I forget his first name in Australia. And basically he said, look, you cannot do anything in Antarctica safely. There is no way to clean up an accident. There is no way to monitor what's really going on. And the best thing about for Antarctica is to remain sacrosanct, never to be violated for anything, let alone fossil fuels or what might be down there. And nobody knew really what was there. So through that access, and also his style, you know, he's very gentle in his arguments. You know, people knew that he loved beauty, and people had such confidence in him because he didn't really grind axes. So we went to, you know, into the Oval Office very easily and have tea with the president. And Cousteau would say, oh, Mr. President, the Yanomami Indians. And then Bush would turn to me and say, what did he say? And I had to kind of like, you know, translate the accent. But the point is that they trusted him and they listened to him. And in the end, the Wellington Convention was scuttled. And in its place is a 50-year moratorium called the Madrid Protocol, where Antarctica itself, the landmass, cannot be exploited. That's a clock that's running now. Probably people are dying to get in there. But I guess, long story short, he was able to use his artistic gifts for political ends. Mm-hmm. And where I came in was to really help him implement ideas, because even when you speak to a president, as probably many of your listeners know, one, it's not so easy to get action after that, even though the top banana, so to speak, wants to move forward. Or maybe the top banana tells Cousteau yes, but then the staff comes in and says, you shouldn't have said yes, that's a terrible idea. So yeah. Then I went in and I had to assuage the staff. But anyway, we had a lot of fun doing things like that.
As I say, my husband, sometimes it doesn't just happen, right?
No.
Because people like you, and that powerhouse of Gusteau work together. Ladies and gentlemen, again today on The Caring Economy, we have Paula DiPerna with us. We're going to talk about many aspects of her career, but now I want to ask her about her book, Pricing the Priceless, The Financial Transformation to Valuing the Planet, Solve the Climate Crisis, and Protect Our Most Precious Assets. Tell our listeners a little bit about the book and the premise.
So the book, you know, I'm not a financial person. I'm not a Wall Street trader. I don't sell stocks. I don't buy stocks. I don't really have much to do directly with finance other than my own little meager savings. Thanks again to Cousteau. I remember we were filming in Alaska. The Exxon Valdez had run aground. Terrible oil spill, lots of sea life, seabirds, all covered with oil, disgusting images. And Cousteau himself said, you know, it was all very sad, but this really sad thing was that America was taking the oil out of the ground at then today's price, which was very low, and then taking it out of the ground, risking oil spills, and then wasting the oil because we didn't have any energy efficiency programs, which, by the way, we still don't have a national energy efficiency program. The fact that he mentioned price, I thought, that's interesting. You know, it's true. How much is this worth? What would it be worth in 5 years, 50 years? And yet here it is spilling all over the sea. But I shelved that because I didn't really have financial experience. And then fast forward, I was representing Cousteau at a UN conference. And there was another mentor there named Richard Sandor, who was a trader and a commodities trader and knew all about financial markets. And he had gotten the bug to address climate change. He was also invited by the UN to weigh in on climate change issues at the Earth Summit in the early 90s. And he and I were at a conference. And basically, Richard said, you know, I think carbon trading, carbon pricing would have a real impact on climate change. But you only know about trading and if it's going to work if you try it. So I think we should find a way to try it. Mm-hmm. So I hear try it, you know, and that lodges in my head. And also pricing picked up on things that Cousteau had said. The book's premise is that we have to price things that have no price. And eventually I went to work with Richard and we created the world's first carbon market, the Chicago Climate Exchange, precisely to price carbon. But all of this comes back to the idea of the book and the main question at the heart of the book, which is again, a common sense question that I think anybody can understand when you focus on it, is how in the world can we value, can our markets value things that are completely dispensable, like Uber or Nespresso coffee machines or any of the other doodads that wealthier people have, which are really only disruptions. They don't really invent anything new. Uber didn't invent anything new. It just disrupted what was called a legacy business. And, you know, what's the value in that per se? Hard to define. But it is valued in the billions of dollars as a company. But how can we value Uber in the billions in the atmosphere at zero? You know, that's the question that the book tries to answer. Whatever Uber's worth, the atmosphere can't be worth less.
And people don't even appreciate it until they lose it, right?
Exactly.
And that now.
Atmosphere is indispensable. Uber is dispensable. So that's at the heart of the book. And the book explores the answer to the question first by my own personal journeys to parts of the world where this dichotomy is very much in evidence, but also then through re-examining lots of conversations that have been had about the shortcoming of the GDP, which only measures output, doesn't measure intangibles other than research and development intangibles. So I was thinking, well, if you can measure research and development intangibles and feed that into the GDP, why can't you value nature and feed that into the GDP as a standing value? Mm-hmm. And so the book explores new econometrics. It's sort of Paula meets environmental economics. So there are these very interesting new tools, which foundations, some of which have kicked in initial funding for, and others of which are just out there on purely commercial basis. But in interesting tools that have found a way to value nature, put a price on the value, that is to say, the benefits, the ecological benefits that have economic value, put a price on that, securitize that, invest in that upfront before the benefits are actually reaped so that you get the benefits. And so your money is not always chasing the downside, but it is able to protect the upside.
And does it also factor in things like health benefits?
No, but that's social finance. And I'm hoping to write a sequel. You mean human health. Those are sort of social impact bonds and things that are, you know, a little bit more advanced, just as risky, but a little bit more advanced. The idea of pay for success. But my book focuses mostly on ecological benefits. And of course, there are ancillary public health benefits, but sure, those can be measured in, but they're not as immediately of the ones that are visible. They are less mentioned in my book, but they are, of course, part of it.
Point about people instinctively understanding this, it would be evident just by how we choose to where we go and go on vacation, where we go, you know, do we want to go to New Zealand and hike, or do we want to go to Peoria, Indiana? But we know instinctively what a healthy environment looks like because we seek it out, even if we don't really appreciate that that's a part of the thinking.
Is that well, and back to you know, today, I don't know, you know, if you followed the output at the Paris Climate Finance Conference, where governments have offered, you know, countries, African developing countries, preferable, lending terms so that they can invest in climate change. And I say that's completely in reverse. My book makes the argument that the countries that are supposedly debtor countries are actually creditor countries. We owe them for holding on to the rainforest. We owe them for the sequestration of carbon. We owe them for the oil that's underground they haven't exploited yet. So why don't we just pay them instead of loaning money?
Yeah, I know you spent a lot of time in Latin America as well, but can you talk a little bit about, I don't know if we should do past and present or in general, but give us a little bit of color about where you see the bright spots globally in action and where you're seeing inaction. Like, we have the Canadian fires going on now. Are some countries on the vanguard? Like, we often hear about Costa Rica being such a green place, or New Zealand, but...
Well, basically there's inaction everywhere. You know, everybody's trying a little something, but it's not really adding up. You know, the numbers are getting very scary in terms of the ability to get at climate change at a cost that's within our reach. I mean, I think Africa, because they're standing firm, you know, they're saying, look, we are not going to just stand by and allow you to, if we go to carbon markets, package our quote offsets so that you in Europe can use them. We're thinking about having our own carbon market in Africa. Mm-hmm. Gabon is a very forward-thinking country as far, you know, which having, you know, Costa Rica is very green, but, you know, it doesn't have much in the way of unsecured resources. You know, mm-hmm. the Congo Basin, obviously the Amazon, these are places where you have still significant carbon sequestration potential, huge rainforests. And I remember in 1992 at the Rio conference when the Amazon was almost, you know, virtually pristine, certainly by today's comparison, you know, very, very vocal activists just said to everybody, look, if the North cares so much about our forests, why don't you just rent them from us? Let's find what a rent would be. And, you know, if we had to, if that had happened, if the industrialized countries had rented the Amazon, and everything would be different today. And absolutely, so would the poverty in Brazil. Now, there are people who say that, well, just a direct payment is subject to corruption. But I would challenge that and say, well, what isn't subject to corruption?
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, I like to look for bright spots. There's some interesting things in Indonesia with regard to, ocean reserves. But, you know, we just have to accelerate everywhere.
So if someone wants to find your book or be in touch, what's the best way, Paula?
Well, I like to think it was on the, I'm doing an event for those who are in New York City. I'll be doing a reading on July 25th at the Salmagundi Club. Should be in your bookstores. It's definitely in Barnes & Noble on the table. That's called Heavyweight Hardcovers, which I don't know if that encourages you to carry it out, but it should be there. And the online edition is available at Wiley.com, the publisher. So if anyone wants it, they should just ask the bookstore to order it if it's not around. But I think it's a good read. And, you know, it really tries to flip the way we've been valuing our nature and natural resources for the general benefit.
And also, I want to pay a compliment from what I've seen or heard. So you talk about the hard table or hard copy books and the big table. But that can sound off-putting, right? But your gift of writing is to be both scientific, analytical, informed, but also to create a narrative or a sort of compelling storytelling. And I wonder if you might talk a little bit about that, because I think that will make the book even more familiar to people who want to pick it up.
Well, thank you for that, because as I said, Mr. Ross must be listening. You know, I did spend a lot of time on every single word. And for me, this was a personal journey. And I wanted it to be beautiful to read, and I wanted it to have rhythm and to have imagery. And, you know, it's not an analytical textbook at all. It's really for anyone who wants to know more about how their money could do better, be more doing good. This is, you know, almost just come on a journey with me, and we'll go around the world and we'll see how we can use money for different purposes. And actually, what is the purpose of money in today's world? That's the sort of metaphysical question.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you could compare and contrast a little bit about either what you've seen or what you perceive of younger readers versus our generation. I would imagine that there's a passion that is kind of exciting in the young people, but maybe it's not quite as experienced or grounded as one might hope. But I'm just guessing.
Yeah, back to mentoring. I mean, there is a passion and there's a lot of concern about climate change. There's a tremendous amount of concern. But, you know, there's a detachment from institutions. And, you know, climate change requires institutional systems-wide investments and changes. It doesn't really matter if you cut your carbon footprint at home. It matters in a way, but it doesn't add up. It used to maybe have a chance of adding up. But now we have to really leverage and put pressure on the institutions. And that includes pension funds, but also one's own spending for products, buy less of the things we don't need is one way. But also engage with institutions more directly, your own bank, if a young person is fortunate enough to be inheriting wealth. What is that wealth going for? What could I do differently with it? And, you know, obviously the so-called younger generation, they're voracious readers, they read a lot, but their reading tends to be more identity focused than institutionally and systems focused. Mm-hmm. And I think we really need to shift from individuality in this case to a common language, which is represented by our institutions. That means the financial institutions, the political ones, even if they are failing us.
Yeah. Well, you know, an example, I mean, let's brainstorm some of this here. You've done it already in your book. A young person might feel that he or she is incapable of doing that institutional approach. But in fact, they do touch many institutions. If you're young, starting out your career, your employer probably does have some kind of financial planning that they offer to you. So you get involved in equity, stock market. You can actually vote with your proxy if you want, right? Like you can actually be informed.
Absolutely.
As a shareholder, even if you're just the tiniest of one, you only need one share to be actively involved in shaping a company's decisions, right?
Absolutely. And you can vote with saying, look, I don't like your position on X or Y. I'm not going to work here, or I'm going to expose you. I mean, you could go that far. So there is definitely, because there's very clear evidence that hiring people, recruiting and retaining talent, which all major employers need and want, depends on the values of the company. Now, that doesn't go entirely to the end point, but then you get the investors who come in and match that value statement with monitoring and scrutiny.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think that's a very good idea for people to act through their employer. And also through, you know, you can almost go as far as lawsuits. There are many lawsuits where younger people are bringing actions against governments for failing to do what I was saying, is represent nature as an asset to be stewarded on the behalf of intergenerational equity, and not to just be exploited and spent as a cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's lots of opportunities, but again, they have to be systemic, I think.
Yeah, and also then voting, right? You get behind candidates who support that kind of action versus passing on voting. Even, you know, I vote even at the school board level because it matters.
Yeah, the voting is very, very critical, even in a significantly partisan environment. And particularly one thing I think that we on the environmental side, even though I've always been a kind of observer, back to your first question, I've never really been a quote tree hugger. I like the outdoors and I love nature and I love to look at beautiful things, but I'm not, you know, out there hiking every 24 hours a day and so on. I'm an urban rat, as it were. But I also, you know, cities are very important. You know, they're dense, so you could get a lot of energy efficiency in a city if we only had better public transportation around the country. And this requires voting and allowing the government to invest in, to suspend one's suspicion of government, just suspend it for like a year and really work on it. And the infrastructure bill, for example, these are very big investments in our country, in the United States. And everybody should be asking their elected representative, well, how does our county get to that money? I don't have broadband at home. I don't have a public transportation. How do I get, how does my county get to that money?
Yeah.
Very, very important. And the other thing about politics is, you know, it is a mirror of us. And if you, if I've learned, if you leave the space to others, others come in. And it, you know, it's like viruses, and we have to push back with a better idea.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, one other final thing on that is, I think our side, and I started to say this, by our side, I mean, you know, the so-called environmental movement, we've always thought of environmental protection as a metaphysical thing, when actually it's really a very practical thing, not only in finance, as I say in my book, but as an employment mechanism. Think of it, 100 years, this is the insanity, Toby, 100 years we have spent digging stuff out of the ground, burning it, letting the atmosphere, letting those emissions go up into the atmosphere. And now the challenge is to do the exact opposite, take it out of the atmosphere, put it back in the ground. That has been the process that has created the Industrial Revolution, this up and now down thing. And, you know, that's the definition of madness, I would say, in a way. And so if we could get quicker into this idea of capturing it, getting it back underground or eliminating it altogether, that's a gigantic jobs creator. You know, I mean, I know there's a lot of jobs displacement, but we haven't emphasized addressing climate change as a major employer.
An opportunity. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's very important for, you know, kids in college and getting out of college and figuring out what to do with their skills.
And also for, you know, an innovation revolution, right? The patents and the innovations that can be created to address it, they're happening, but they're just going to become even more important. So I'm with you. I tend to be optimistic in this generation that's coming up and in the long term, but not because I think it's going to happen naturally, no pun intended. We need to really stay vigilant. We need to engage people, as we're doing here with this podcast, with your book. So I'm optimistic, but I guess I would say my husband sometimes says I'm a bitter optimist, pragmatic optimist.
Well, fortunately, there are a lot of days in the year, so you can be one way, one day and one day the other. But, I tend to be optimistic. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of a drag to get out of bed in the morning. But I think we really have to rehabilitate our institutions, and that, you know, that requires scrutiny, kindness, open-mindedness, and fresh views, and anything to open up the systems and push them to move quicker. We're just moving too slowly.
Yeah, I love the open source approach. We always ask our guests sort of like pearls of wisdom that you've gleaned through your life, maybe for young people, but even for people who might be older or a little bit disillusioned. What sort of tips do you have for a successful career and a successful life?
Well, I guess one of the things is almost a cliche now, which is don't ignore your passions. You know, follow your passions. A smaller version of that would be, if it's a good idea, do it. And a woman named Cora Weiss gave me that advice when I took over the Joyce Foundation, back to philanthropy, you know, rules. But don't get hung up in, you know, convention. If it's a good idea, try to find a way to do it. And, you know, no one is above you. No one is above you. Authority is above you, but you can challenge authority with respect. And that is very important today. And the other thing is, you know, embrace beauty, you know, beauty in people, in imagery and locations. Beauty is free to all. And if you embrace it, you get a lot of payback.
Awesome. I love that. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank Paula DePerna for joining us today. We all need to pick up her book, Pricing the Priceless. You can find it in bookstores. You can find it online. And we'll look forward to having you come back before the sequel is written to see how it's going.
Thank you, Toby. I appreciate it. Take care now.